have an action-packed higher learning podcast for you today. I'm joined by Alex Draper, the CEO and founder of DX Learning, a company that is changing the face of culture for organizations big and small. Alex is one of the most energetic and exuberant people I've been around. He has so many great ideas around building leadership, culture coining, and we even got to talk a little bit of English football, Arsenal and Liverpool. So I hope you love this episode as much as I do. I think you can notice the natural chemistry. Can't wait for you to listen. Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid. And today, my friends, we have a very special guest. Today, I am joined by Alex Draper. Alex is the CEO and founder of DX Learning. How you doing, Alex?
Not too bad. Thanks for having me, Oz.
Of course, man. I am so grateful. I know you're in the beautiful city of Chicago. How long have you been in Chicago?
Since 2005, the Windy City, which is nice and sunny today.
Yes, this is the time of year that everybody wants to move to Chicago because the weather is beautiful. All the great things are going on. I'm actually a little bit jealous. I'm here in Fort Lauderdale, but Chicago's one of my favorite cities.
Well, only until what, November, and then you want to get out.
Then I'm back down here in Florida, that's for sure. So, brother, I want to start here because you've got one of the most amazing stories and finding a business and being an entrepreneur. I know you and I can both empathize on that. We've had a beer over that and shared kind of some war stories. What can you tell us about DX? What's the vision of the company? And then why did you start the company?
Why we started the company is not what it is now, but it's similar. So I started DX with the purpose of wiping out bad leadership, having been on the receiving end of bad leadership. And being quite honest, my dad was not the best leader in the world. And so both at home and at work, I know what it feels like to be on the receiving end of someone or a group of people who don't have you back, who send you home more stressed than when you came, and you don't look forward to when you come back the next day. So being on the receiving end of that, I knew I wanted to do something about it. So DX was started, 9 years ago this month. So it's our 9th birthday. Happy birthday, DX.
Woo-hoo! Congrats.
One more year. We reached double figures.
Came up for that party. Make sure I get
in. Yeah, there'll be a lot of wine. It's interesting as when you start a company, the purpose is still the same, but it's fascinating how the message can change. So wiping out bad leadership, we primarily sell to CHROs and executives. And if you tell them we're wiping out bad leadership, they automatically assume that, well, that's not me. It's not so good for marketing and sales. So the message is similar, but to reduce workplace toxicity, I think we can all admit or know that even in a great culture, there's always pockets of toxicity. So regardless of where you're at, our job is to reduce whatever toxicity exists in whatever team that you work in.
Yeah, listen, it's a very important space. It's a fascinating space. One you and I are both very passionate about. I'm interested. I want to go back to something. I don't want to pick any old scab wounds, but I just find it interesting that you brought up your father and leadership there. And it's funny because I have 4 kids and we've talked about how we're both fathers. And I have looked at my children almost from like a management and leadership perspective. What's funny is that like when they were 4, 5, 6 years old and like getting like emotional tizzies and like we're like freaking out and having tantrums, like I could never really handle that. I was never like the dad I felt like I needed to be in that moment. My wife was always very good there. But as they've gotten older, and I've been able to reason with them, and I've been able to motivate them, and I've been able to do a lot of the things that I think have made me successful as a manager and leader in corporate America, I really am kind of playing like a CEO leadership role sometimes with them too. And I just find it funny that there's differences, obviously, but like there's a lot of synergy there too. You agree?
It's, you know what, you nailed it on the head in the fact that end of the day, whether it's a kid, so I coach soccer, I'm a father, I'm a husband, I lead my team, I've got 19 members down here. I've got crew all over the world. Same rules apply, man. It's like, so for me, leadership is just one human being positively influencing another human being. So whether that's my kids, my wife, my team, whether I'm coaching, I'm talking to you, my leadership is you lead the conversation feeling positively influenced. And you're right. It's everywhere, every day. And what's the challenge about it is we're all different. There's 8 billion human beings. We all have a brain and a heart, most of us anyway. But we're all uniquely different. So how you treat one kid will be different how you treat another kid and how you treat you. So we have to adapt. And I think that's the problem that we've got is we don't adapt and we try and do a one size fits all. And there ain't no one size fits all. to anything out there. Probably the same in your industry.
Yeah, for sure. And like I think about it, and I don't know, I've given a ton of thought about this, but like the great leaders that we know, the ones that are truly servant leaders, there's probably like a Venn diagram of very little overlap of also being great parents, because a lot of the like serving others and taking care of others and like you said, customizing your approach for different kids, different employees, really important. So there's a lot of synergy there. Who knew this was going to turn into a parenting podcast? I'm sure we could go for hours on that. I want to take this in a little bit of a different direction though. I'm very interested. When you initially started the company, you mentioned that your mother's words of not being vulnerable and focusing on getting shit done was the priority. So that's kind of how the company started. But over time, that wasn't working the way you intended. So I'm just interested, when did you have that inflection point? And when did you realize that you had to evolve into a leader that was different to get more impact, more influence?
Yeah. Oh God. How'd you depack this one? I've heard it and I believe it is we want the things we never had as a child. So, you know, I grew up in a lack of vulnerability, right? So British, tough family, don't talk about your feelings, don't be vulnerable, just suck it up. Suck it up, fuzzball. That's how I grew up. Right or wrong, not right, not wrong. It's just how it is. I now seek those things and I try and be the things that I didn't have. So where it all went wrong though, because that's how I started the business, because that's all I know is hard work. I am grit personified due to my upbringing. That's not a bad thing, but if it's not used or harnessed, it can be a bad thing. My first 5 years of DX, 4 years of DX, it manifested itself in the fact that all I knew was to work hard. And therefore the values of the company was, come into DX, we're trying to wipe out bad leadership. Everything's going to be amazing. I care about you. It's going to be a great culture. I expect you to do your best work, but don't worry about it. You can go home with a smile and blah, blah, blah. Actually, what it ended up to be, those are my words, but my action was, you better work out, because I worked hard. There was this undertone of, oh shit, if he's working hard, I got to work hard. And if he's sending emails at 12 o'clock at night, I got replied to emails at 12 o'clock at night. So it wasn't what I said and the best intentions were there. It's what I modeled. And I lost a lot of good people. And that was when I had that inflection point of, well, shit, I can't grow a company unless I have people. Because if you keep getting churn and you don't keep good people, which I had good people, then how am I going to grow this business and reduce workplace toxicity? So that was my, you can't just say it, you got to do it. And those two things have got to go hand in hand.
Yeah, there's a really interesting dichotomy here. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. So we go and we advise clients all the time, companies big and small, about how do you be amazing at hiring, right? We've seen thousands of companies and done tens of thousands of hires and worked with every candidate and seen every hiring situation at all. And so I feel this extreme burden to make sure I eat my own dog food. And that our talent acquisition and the way that we hire, I feel this pressure. I've got this big role that I'm getting ready to hire. I don't know if I've ever been so stressed and had so much anxiety for something that I'm supposed to be, you know, an expert in and advising clients in. And I want to make sure I get it right. And I'm going through all this due diligence. And there's a little bit of, you know, I hope I get this right, which you wouldn't think if that's your bread and butter, that's how you'd feel. Similarly, you're going and talking to companies about workplace toxicity and culture. And you turn around 3-4 years in, you're like, I don't have the culture that I want in this company. Can talk about that. How do you reconcile that as an entrepreneur? Because this is supposed to be what you're selling, what your area is, what you're passionate about.
Hey man, accountants suck with money. Doctors smoke and do drugs. People in my industry, we don't drink our own Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
Which has got to stop, man. I mean, it's the authenticity, right? How can I stand up and some of our clients and go, we're here to fix your culture and my own culture, it sucks. It's just, I truly believe the young will sniff you out pretty quickly. Now, in your world and my world, it's the things that I tolerated growing up, and I have a huge tolerance, huge. I got thick skin because of my upbringing, because of the things that have been thrown at me. And I'm an entrepreneur, you just have to be. And I think you said it, right? You got to have the stomach for it. The young don't have that. They're just not willing to tolerate that. And I think that's great, by the way. I think what's happening in the world should have happened years ago. With the expectations of the young generations coming in, as they won't put up with the crap that we put up with in terms of bad culture, bad leadership, those sort of things, say one thing, do another. And nor should they have, or nor should we have. So And that's changing our hiring practices, and it's changing our cultural practice. Like, what we do is pretty much joined at the hip, because you can't hire great people into a toxic culture, because it's a waste of their money and waste of your time. And it's, although it's probably quite good for the churn rates, but let's not go down that path. But we are interconnected. It's talent acquisition and talent development have to be joined at the hip.
Totally agree. And like, to your point, your culture and what your environment is either brings out the best in people or takes the best and brings them down, and brings them down to a level of they don't love their work, they're not challenged, they don't like the people they work with. And so you're right. These two things have to go hand in hand. And I think it's one of the biggest mistakes companies make is bifurcating talent management and talent acquisition and not having an integrated strategy there. To me, that makes zero sense. I think they go hand in hand. Hiring somebody great, onboarding them properly, managing performance, and building a culture they can thrive in are all tied at the hip. And if you've got dissimilar strategies across the board, then you're just setting yourself up for failure. So I totally agree with that. I love how passionate you are about the current workforce. And we've talked a little bit about the generational challenges and how to reach employees coming from different backgrounds and perspectives. And just to your point, just less tolerance for dealing with bullshit, right? And like, that's really what it is. I'm with you. I grew up in rub some dirt in it, like toughen up, you know, and fight through it. And listen, there's byproducts of that, good and bad, right? That also, like, you know, dealing with adversity. And I'm kind of a masochist about it. Like, I'm walking through, like, hitting, getting hit with cannonballs. I'm wearing armor, and it's like, bring it on, let's go. That can be a bad thing, but it also can help you survive and struggle when times get tough. And sometimes we're seeing the downside of that. How do you advise people like me, people who are working with early in career talent, about how you manage to those differences and build a culture that can be inclusive of somebody who's maybe a baby boomer and somebody who's Gen Z and everything in between?
My advice, and I'll offer it as such, based on experience and what I know, is don't assume. So, but quick science lesson, right? We're as human beings, we're running advanced societal software technology on caveman technology hardware, our brains, and we're just not ready. We're trying to process around 11 million bits of information every second. To do that, we've created heuristics are shortcuts to make judgments and decisions as quickly as possible, so that our brain can still scan for threats. We've just swapped out saber-toothed tigers for bosses. And the negative effect of a heuristic is a bias. We've all got them. There's about 188. So here's my advice. We're all biased. We all suck at this stuff, and it's perfectly human. When I say assumptions, really heuristics and biases are assumptions. Our brain has to make assumptions in order to process the information at speed in order to survive and cognitively take in all this information. So a lot of what we're saying, I mean, my advice then, long-winded answer is, don't assume just because someone is young that they're not resilient. Don't assume just because I'm British, I've got bad teeth. Don't assume that someone who's a baby boomer, doesn't care, right? We've just got to stop the generalizations and the assumptions of people in general. I mean, it's just, every human being is uniquely different, has a unique experience based upon their parents, their first teacher, their friends, their first boss, are all create this human being that's me. And what motivates me might not motivate you. Now, you may assume you think you know what motivates me, but you know what happens when you make assumptions? You make an ass out of you and me. And that's the problem that we've got to fix. There is no one size fits all remedy to anything. It's just me sitting down with you and going, what does motivate you? What does success look like? What do I need to do to bring out the best in you? And to take the filters off and the judgments and the assumptions, and to sit there and use the two ears, one mouth, as we were gifted, and listen. And we've just got to learn to listen and stop talking, is my advice to any executive and CEO, anyone trying to grow, is just stop talking, start learning, don't make assumptions. Every human being is different. Don't generalize, and just get to know the human that's in front of you right here, right now.
Fantastic advice. It takes more work. It takes more thinking. It takes more thoughtfulness. That's okay. That means for better relationships, better performance, better world. I totally agree with you. Trying to put people in boxes, not giving people the benefit of the doubt. One of the things I like to say is, and I'm not perfect at it by any stretch of the imagination, but like one thing I learned a long time ago was don't make judgments among people, right? Collect data points. Like, especially when I'm first meeting somebody and getting to know them, no matter what they do, I'm not going to say this is this person in totality. But if I get to know you over the course of a couple months and I collect like three or four data points, well, then I'm going to say, okay, this might be their character. This might be who they are. But I never try to let that be kind of the first thing, because sometimes we're having a bad day. Sometimes we're not fitting into the stereotype that you think we are. Sometimes we're, you know, in a moment, in a circumstance where we handle it this way this time, and then in a very different circumstance, we handle it this way. There's no silver bullet. And we're all like, you know, like you said, we're a little bit heuristically lazy and we're just trying to get to the answer as fast as possible. And then we take shortcuts. And then when we take shortcuts, then we can lead to really bad outcomes, right? So yeah. 1000% with you. And for what it's worth, I think you have great teeth. So I thought that from the beginning.
I'm Americanized now. I got a new accent. I got new teeth. Might even have Botox.
Yeah, when you go through customs, they just hand you new teeth and throw them in, right? My guy Jurgen Klopp must have done that. So you and I discussed culture coining previously. Companies talking about who they are, but not being the actual work experience and how detrimental that can be. How do companies go from being aspirational to their values to actually having it be like part of their DNA? And I know this is kind of some of the secret sauce of DX, but I'm just interested. How do you get it from being, here's what we say we are versus this is who we are?
Yeah, I'll start with a statement and then maybe ask some questions about your business, because I know you have a significantly sized business with a couple of hundred employees. So you've done something right. But let's just, so for me, the culture of a company or team is a mirror of its leadership. So you and I started the business. The business tends to be a culture of us as we begin it. And sometimes we don't even write those values down. It's just through our actions. And like me, I modeled grit. So everyone else modeled grit, right? Basic mirror neurons, right? The same neurons fire in your brain that fire in mine. So if I was to put a pinprick in my finger right now, the same neuron would fire in your brain and you'd wince. Oh my God. Same with leadership. So if I'm smiling and I come in with inspiration, that will rub off on you guys. If I come in with stress and I'm like, ooh, and everything's depressing, then that just rubs off on the team and they have cortisol in their brain as well. So just culture is a mirror of leadership. So what do we need to do? We need to create a box around leaders about how we expect them to behave, because leadership is just what you value drives what you behave. Mm-hmm. So how do we create great cultures to stop the what you say versus what you do? Values are so important. You know, here's our values, and there's three behaviors under each one of those values. It's simple. Five values, 15 behaviors. Every single person in this company, every Friday, we have values moments. We back that up. We hire on values. We fire on values. If you do not abide by the expected behaviors, even if you're high performing, there's a door. And that's the worst part of my job, man. It's I got to hire. I need to go to people like you and say, I need the person who behaves like this, that will be a cultural add, not a cultural fit. And that's the tough part of it. And it's not only hiring on it, it's firing on it. And also when you to sustain it, your performance management has to be based on those behaviors. So culture is a mirror of leadership. You've got to articulate the values in a human way, no more than probably seven or eight values, maybe even five or six. There's got to be behaviors that you are witnessable. You can either see them or hear them. And then you've got to reward the positive, consequence the negative, hardwire into performance management. Then that's a real culture, right? It's beyond ping pong tables and bloody baseball bat, whatever it is. That's a real culture. And culture conning happens from when you say you're pioneering, which is one of our values, yet you don't challenge the status quo. In fact, that's one of the behaviors. You should never, ever say, this is just how things have got done, and that's how they always are. I will fire you on the spot for that. So that's the key for me. It's values, behaviors, and sustainability through processes and metrics.
I love that. All right. So you got a question for me.
You do. So how have you sustained? You're beyond probably the inflection point of where it's not just you, it's a business. How did you move from the business being a subset of how I behave and how I model to having a set of values, behaviors, and where are you on your culture journey as you heard me talk?
Great question. So company started back in 2011, and in our first office we put eight values emblazoned on the wall, right? And I would tell you that I played a big role in what those values were and what how like my success was tied to them in a lot of ways. So accountability, right? I'm always looking at inward first before I'm pointing the finger at anybody. So no victim blaming, right? Integrity, right? What I say is what I do. My follow through is as close to 100% as it can be. Respect, respect where other people come from, respect different points of views, have a level of respect because we work together, right? And give people the benefit of the doubt. Quality, right? Always wanted, my mom always used to tell me, when you sign your name to anything, make sure it's something that you'd be proud to put your name behind, that there's quality behind that. Innovation, right? Where are we coming up with new ideas? Or do we foster great ideas from our employee base? We do different things and programs around that, right? There is customer focus, right? Something that's super important to me in terms of focusing in on our customers and giving them an experience that they're going to love and that they're going to remember. Will to win is something that I think personifies me, right? When the adversity is up against you and you're in a position where things are at their toughest, how do you stand up after you get knocked down 7 times and get up that 8th time? How do you show that ability to go above and beyond to win? And how do you show a winning attitude and mindset? And then lastly, but certainly not least, is collaboration. How do we come together and where the sum is more important than the whole? And how do we come together and we can all do great things individually, but man, it's nothing. It can't touch what happens when we all come together and put our superpowers together. So those are our 8 values. Put them up on a wall. Whether it was a self-fulfilling prophecy or we were just really prescient, those qualities really personify who we are as an organization. So how does that manifest itself? Well, in our new office, it's the first thing you see when you walk in. We do on our Monday morning all hands meeting, we do recognition for somebody that helped you out or really did something excellent the week before. And we make you a line of value to that. So Jacqueline did XYZ and it was one of the best things I've seen that we put out on social media. And so I want to give her quality for that value. I think she's done an amazing job. We've since built cultural totems that really kind of align through our values. Our values are tributaries to those cultural totems that like things like having a growth mindset, not having a victim mindset, right? Leading by example, right? Those are different things that are part of who we are. And we interview against those as well. And then certainly questions that I'm asking in our interview process are trying to identify, do these values matter to you, who you are? And then last and probably the most important one, the biggest award we give in the company is at the end of the year. And it's for somebody that personified our values and cultural most. It's not results. It's the person that is our cultural totem and has exemplified that throughout the course of the year. And that award is done at our holiday party, which is a big extravagant event that we do. We give you a blue jacket like you get a green jacket at the Masters, and it's called the Will to Winner. So the Will to Winner is the most prestigious award you can have in the company. Another thing, when you walk in, it has on the plaque everybody's names and the year they won it and all that. So I say that to say that this was all very intentional, right? And it's something that we live and that we do and breathe. And it's something that we definitely hire and fire around, and we definitely make sure everybody knows those values. In fact, it's on one of our first training tests that you do too. So that's my answer.
Very rare that you meet someone who let me just say, gets it, right? And whether it was intentional or not, it's where you've ended up. So give yourself a pat on the back, because culture is the number one thing that the young are looking for. They if you can't answer the question, describe your culture. Well, how do I know that leaders are going to live and breathe it? Like, those are the questions that kids are asking in interviews. And I asked you that question. There was, hey, anyone listening? When we had a beer, we did not discuss this. So I put Oz on the spot and you heard his answer. So that's, gosh, because if you can't answer.
Let me share one more thing with you, because I want to be vulnerable here, because I think that's an important part of leadership. But I want to, you know, this is something we can talk about offline. But so you asked where my culture is at right now. Okay. Company's been around for 13 years. I think we've created an environment where people love the people they work with. They love coming to work. They believe in what we're doing. They're part of something bigger than themselves. There's a sense of security and safeness. So much so that what I've noticed over the last 14 to 16 months, right? It's been kind of a tough market as well, is that sometimes that breeds casualness, entitlement, a lack of driving for performance, which, by the way, like, is anathema to me. This is how I grew up, right? And so one of the things that is we focus so much on the aspects of culture of making people feel secure and heard and listened to, that in some ways we've kind of mitigated or made secondary some of the performance and competitiveness that I think personified us earlier on. And so where we're at as a company, we've hit this area where it's a great company. Everybody would be very proud to say, wow, this is a great company. It's, you know, this is more than you could have ever expected when you open the doors. However, to get to that next step, to go from good to great, to go, what got us here won't get us there. All the cliches, all the books that are out there, right? We know that we got to turn that performance dial up a little bit more and make that a bigger part of who we are and what we're doing to take that next big step. Because nobody wants to be in a mediocre company long-term. They want to be part of a rocket ship that's doing real things. And that's an area where I wouldn't say we're bad, but we need to fine tune and take that. And so adding to your culture over time or re-injecting something that's important to your culture happens as your company evolves, because culture is iterative. It's an ecosystem, right? That is constantly evolving. And if you can turn around a year later and be like, oh my God, everything's changed, right? Through some bad hires or some bad practices or not modeling the leadership. And so that's where we're at right now, where I'm constantly thinking about culture and I'm super intentional about it. And even though that my first answer, it sounds like you would like that, it's something that we're continuing to build on and think about day in and day out, because it's part of what drives us, but it's part of going to be the thing that either holds us back or takes us to that next level.
Yeah, it's a living, breathing organism that changes through the environment and the people. And look, we live in a complex, diverse world that literally in the last 2 years has dramatically changed. COVID changed it, and the people that are coming in. So you just, it's like anything, like, and this whole conversation has been around how there is no one size fits all. There is no silver bullets. Literally anything from parenting to leadership to coaching kids to Arsenal winning the championship for the first time in 22 years, maybe. There's no silver bullet. You adapt. What Arsenal Wenger did in his first couple of years is not how he ended. So just we all have to adapt and adapt with the times. And the ones that probably win the most, the ones that are, one, most resilient, and two, have that growth mindset for learning and just knowing that we've got to be flexible.
Well, and listen, the last thing you want to be is like an Arsenal fan who's looking back 20 years ago on the good old years and like how great we used to be and standing on that, when really it's today's business, it's today's work, right? So that's where I really hope for both Arsenal fans and companies that we don't just rest on our laurels from our previous success. We continue to strive to be amazing and great going forward. And I'm saying this as a Liverpool fan, and you never walk alone. And I love my Reds. Right now, I got to give you guys credit. When we met last in person, we were in a lot better spot in terms of the championship race. Let go of the rope a little bit. Not sure what happened there. So I'll tell you what, I'm cheering for you. I'm not cheering for City. Too much City in my life over the last 5-6 years. I'm actually hoping Arsenal breaks through this year.
Well, thank you. Any City supporters who are listening to this obviously won't be listening anymore, but you know what? Give us a chance, man. It's time for a change.
Yeah, there's only three of them, so don't worry about it. We're only going to look for listeners. All right, brother, let's talk about hiring. So you built a company. You know, you advise companies on culture. You know, I'm sure you have a lot of intention around how you're hiring. So my first question for you is, what is your core hiring philosophy? And you've kind of given us a little bit of insight in that already, but do you have like a core sentence or philosophy that you adhere to when it comes to bringing in people into DX?
It's a question I've pondered and one I don't have an answer for in terms of consistency. The last hire, which was my chief of staff, which we deliberated over, and again, we're 9 people, so much smaller scale. So every single human being that comes in at this stage of our evolution is all eyes are on them. But we do use the word cultural add versus cultural fit. The philosophy is to understand, so, you know, using strength finders, using some assessments to understand if this person's going to work with this person, in this case, it's me, what are my core strengths and what are my core weaknesses? And from a behavioral point of view, how can this person add, not fit, add to the team? So we just use, from a philosophical point of view, it's just mentally, is this person an ad? Because a fit just means you're creating a bunch of clones and no one wants to work for 8 Alexes. I mean, it's bad enough having one, let alone 8. So just being really intentional and deliberate about, is this an ad versus a fit?
Yeah, I love that. I really love that distinction. I think it's really important. I think it's how you actually really have real diversity, equity, and inclusion conversations when you're looking to not just fit into the homogenous or monochrome of what you have, and you're actually trying to add to it, to build it and continue to make that ecosystem better and that organism bigger and better. I love that. I think it's an important differentiation. I hope people took notes there, because I really, really think that's an important distinction to make. When it comes to questions though, okay, so you got a favorite one that you like to ask in interviews? Anything that comes to mind when I say that?
I just love the question in general. I ask it a lot, which is, hey, just what's one thing I don't know about you that would just improve our relationship and our trust? Because I just want to hear how they answer that question. Because it's especially if I don't know them and if it's the interview process, it's just they have an opportunity to tell me something about them that they believe would improve our trust. And where they go of it, because they have full autonomy, they could go anywhere, right? It's what's one thing that he doesn't know about me that would improve our working relationship here? It just opens up the floor to just understanding how their brain works and understanding what's important to them and what motivates them, because that's really what in a small company like us that's on the hockey stick, it's I need people who can answer that question, number one, pretty darn quickly. But more importantly, it's making sure what's important to them and what motivates them is in this sort of growth phase of our business. So it's a relationship question, it's a behavioral question, but it's a question I just enjoy asking.
Here's what we do on this podcast. We like to spin a question around on you. So, what is something I don't know about you that's going to build our trust and rapport? I got an answer. I'm going to answer after you. I do the same. I put
Okay.
myself on the spotlight.
That knowing that you have Indian descendancy, that my mum was born in India, and that my granddad was a tea planter, and that I crave the opportunity to go back to India, and I'd love that to be a, you know, there's a that's an intrigue that I have that I'd like to I enjoy talking to people about.
That's an amazing answer. And now I've got a throwaway answer that you're going to hate, but I'm going to say it. I tend to generalize people with a British accent as being more intellectual than they might be. So from the minute I met you, I'm like, I love this guy. He's got so much to offer and say. So that's something about me you didn't know. And that's why I think from the minute we started talking, I'm like, oh, I like this guy. He's got things I can learn from him.
I love it. And you know what? 9 times out of 10, you're wrong because you made an assumption.
I love it. All right. So, what about memorable interview experiences? I'm interested. Either you were interviewing or you were interviewing somebody. Anything memorable come to mind?
So when I was interviewing, I hired him, bless him, Matt Sandel. His second interview, in fact, no, his first interview was, hey, let's go. This is early on, and this is 5 years ago. So, you know, I'm only 9 years old. So, he's the second longest standing employee, and it must have worked. I'm like, let's go for a beer. So, the interview was sharing a couple of Coronas. It actually ended up in more Coronas. And I'm like, you know what? I can work with this guy. So, that was probably my most memorable interview, was just in a pub, and just knowing that this is someone I could go to war with, because that's really what it was. And it's like, that's. I truly believe when you're in this phase of business and you're just starting out, you've got to surround yourself with people that you can go to war with. And for me, that when I had a few drinks or more with Matt, it was like, I can go to war with this guy. And look, we're still together right now, through thick and thin. On the receiving end, holy moly, the worst was, it was not expected, but it was a genius. So the interview was to one of my first jobs. I was like, wait, walked into the place back in England, and they did financial acumen as their training. So I've always been in the training world per se. My first job was business and financial acumen training, and they put me through my paces of, look, we're going to do a simulation together, and we're going to test your financial acumen using the simulation that we actually teach others. And I was like, just whoa, there's no questions, there's nothing. It was walk in. And we're basically going to test your financial literacy using the same sim. And it will always, because I failed miserably. So I always remember it, because we tend to learn more by our failures than we do anything else. And I failed miserably. Somehow I managed to blag my way through, and actually they hired me, but I failed the test hands down. I walked out of that with my head between my legs, going, holy shit, man, I am not only do I need to increase my financial acumen, but these guys are never going to offer me a job because I failed it miserably. So that will always. I always remember it because of just how I felt afterwards, of just the misery of, I don't know anything about finance.
Well, I'm glad you got hired, but I don't even know what the point of having a test is that somebody fails and you still hire them. I mean, it looks like it worked out for them and for you, but that sounds like a not a great test strategy. Secondly, we call it like the car ride trip. Like, would you be willing to get in the car with this person for 4 or 5 hours and like be able to have a conversation with them and get along with them? Hopefully, pull up to a happy hour and get a beer. I'm totally with you. I think it's, go to war is a great way to say it. I would also say, is this somebody that like I'm gonna like want to show up and go to work with and like I actually care about who they are outside of work and like. I want to build a relationship with them outside of just what we're doing on this project management or what we're doing on this marketing collateral. You want to try to do as much as possible. And I think we've done a great job of building an organization of people that just are, you like coming to work with and that like you respect and you like and are smart. And doesn't mean you agree about everything. Certainly doesn't mean you agree about everything, but there's certainly some simpatico there of people that I like to spend time with. And I think if you build an environment like that, I think you're going to be much more successful than not. Yeah. Last question on the hiring side, I want to know kind of like about how you give people a realistic job preview of what it's like to work with DX and you during the interview. Like, are you just like, you bring them into the office? Do you, you know, really kind of let them know the good, bad, and the ugly? Like, how do you give them a realistic experience of what to expect when they come in?
Once they've passed a certain phase, we just highlight two or three employees that they're more than likely going to work with on a regular basis. And just give them half an hour of with the premise of the person, the DX employee, walk them through what it's like here from your lens and what it's like to work with you and what the job entails. So just that's all that we've done so far in terms of understanding what it's gonna be like to work here. When it comes to the work products and just what we do in the mission, we get them to participate on our leadership development experiences so that they can at least see what we do in the mission. Because if you don't, passion is one of our values and believing in what you do and drinking our own Kool-Aid. If you don't believe in the mission, well, this ain't the place for you. So they will participate on a program of ours so that they can get that intrinsic motivation and then speak to the people that they'll work with on a daily basis about what it feels like and what the team dynamics are. So that's the best that we've done so far.
Love that. Yeah, I lied. I'm going to ask one more hiring question. When you miss on somebody, because we all miss from time to time, is there a theme you can look back at where you can say, God, I wish I would have done this differently? Or
I mean, there's so many. I can't. It's painful. This is a painful question.
Yeah, but it's like a therapy session here. Why don't you put down on the couch back there?
I've missed more than I've hit. So this is a tough one for me. I have not. Here's the worst part, and maybe you can give me some advice here, which is I seem to go wrong more often than not when I ask the referrals, testimonials. I just think it's a load of BS because they always just say the same bloody thing. This person's amazing. I'm like, how do I get to find out what it's really like to work with this person? Because in the interview process, I can, you know full well, many can, it's like acting, right? You can act your way through a lot of stuff. And I know there's some behavioral questions. There's things that you can do, but if you're good at acting, you can do a pretty good job in the interview process. But there's a piece to me that which goes, I don't care about you. I care about people who have worked with you. And I want to know what it's like to work. To our earlier point, right? I want to go to war with this. Can I go to war with this person? Of course, they're going to say yes. But 9 times out of 10, I'm not going to go for a couple of beers with them because, you know, we're hiring people all over. I've got to rapidly assess whether I can go to war with this person. What's the best way to find out? It's finding out from previous people who've worked with them, because you don't change. I am me, right? I'll probably change over 20 years, but in the last 5 years, this is what you get, right? How I turn up. So how do I've got it wrong by not finding either the right people to ask, what's it like to work with this person? The ones that will give you the honest answer or asking the right questions of the right person. That's where I seem to have failed. Because afterwards, and they didn't win. I'm like, I called up some, I'm like, yeah, you know what? That makes sense now. Well, I wish you told me that 3 years ago, whatever it is. So
I'll give you some, here's some thoughts on this. So there's a lot of reasons why people miss, right? And it sounds like yours is more tied to kind of the references. I'll get to that in a second, but
yep.
Poor design of the role, right? Poor explanation of what's good and bad in the company and just kind of selling the good stuff. Hiring somebody that acts like you, thinks like you, looks like you, creating that homogenous. Those are all things that can lead to issues, right? Getting sold, right? I always tell people that when I hire people, I subtract whatever I like about them by 50%, and whatever I don't like about them, I add 50%. Okay, wait, did I get that right? Whatever I think I'm getting, I subtract by 50%. And then if I still want to hire them, then I know. Because I know that in an interview situation, I'm getting your best self. I'm getting your best answer. And if I could take away 50% of that and still be like, I still like this person, I'll hire them. That's another thing that I think about. But specifically about the referrals, here's two things I would recommend. One is referrals are like one of the dumbest things ever, because if you can get three people to talk about you're good, right? Then you're not even fit to not be hired. You're not fit for much. So everybody's going to have three people that they can talk to. The two things that I would do is, hey, can you find somebody that they didn't refer that's worked with them? So either you go through your LinkedIn and see a first degree connection and reach out to them and say, I'd like to just ask a quick question. Or if you can find somebody in your network that has worked with them, that soft referral is always where you're going to get a more likely and trusted answer. Second, what I would do is, if you can't get that and you're having to just rely on a referral, the way you ask questions and the type of questions you ask can help. So, you know, instead of saying, what's your biggest weakness, which is like the biggest layup you can ever give anybody, right? I ask this: what are not your core skills, and what would we need to augment around you to make sure you're successful in this role? If you ask that of a reference, you're going to get some visibility into where this person struggled or where the challenges are. Because if you don't ask and dig into that, they're not going to offer that up. Like if somebody was like not super reliable, but like they did good work, and my kind of philosophy is I'm not going to kill anybody on the way out. Maybe it's just not a fit here, but I might talk about like, oh, they were unbelievable at selling, and they brought this to our organization. But I'd have maybe, unless you uncovered it for me, I'd probably have a hard time saying, well, actually, they're not the most reliable person. So that's one way to do it. Another one is, so if I told you this person was eligible for rehire, right? How quickly would you rehire them? Or like, why haven't you rehired them, right? And how they answer that is going to give you a lot of insight into what they really think about that person. If it's somebody that they're talking good about or somebody they actually want to work with, because that's ultimately the biggest litmus test. So there's no perfect answer there, but I do think to the type of questions you ask, to the references they give you, and if you can identify references that they didn't give you, I think those are the two best ways to kind of mitigate that.
Thanks for the advice.
You got it. All right, let's talk about this. What are you working on right now that you're really excited about?
Ooh. Book. The book comes out May 21, man. So
Come on. That was my next question. You're killing me. All right. Tell us about the book. Let's go. Okay. Tell us about the book.
All right. So what am I really excited about? So before the book then, because that was a plug, shameless plug. So before the book, we're also working on a... so we're moving the transition of the company from being a boring old tick box leadership training company that we have been for 9 years into a human performance consulting business. Because what we realized in the last 2 years is the great work that we have done is actually not been training. It's actually solving real problems with business leaders. Taking the worst performing manufacturing plant of a large manufacturing company and literally making it mid-tier now. Taking 14 general managers and having three of them being promoted to presidents. This is real work. We're like, holy crap, we're doing real work. It's not training. So but to be a consulting company, you need a consulting tool. So we're close now to having a consulting tool that really helps leaders, organizations diagnose really when it comes to the human skills within the business. That's reframed from soft. There is nothing soft about leadership. Parenting and leadership are the two worst things I've ever done. And I've done a lot of things in my life. Of which they're both leadership. There is nothing soft, and we've got to stop saying soft skills. There's nothing soft about leadership. Mm. So anyway, we're reframing that to human skills, and that's going to be our gift to the world. And we've got the clarity, autonomy, relationships, and equity, care, those human skills. So we're nearly finished in the creation of a living, breathing, like a glint, listening tool that allows leaders and teams to understand, do we need more clarity? Do we need to dial down autonomy? Real time, an understanding of what the team needs more of. It's like an engagement survey, but actually does something good for once and actually gives you real time data to make improvements. So that's what we're working on. Really excited about it.
That sounds fantastic. Well, I'm going to keep up to date on that. Can you give us updates? That's amazing. Really, really cool thing that you're doing there. All right. So I'm going to tell you that we're going to edit out the last about the book, but we're not, because I think it's authentically hilarious. And so I'm just going to pretend organically like I'm bringing this up for the first time. So, Alex, I like to ask typically at this time of the podcast, what's a good book you've read? I know this is the shock. Who knew this was coming? But it sounds like that you have a favorite book that we want to talk about here. I'm going to read this LinkedIn post, and I want to ask you, what's the book about and why did you decide to write it? Exciting news to share. After 4 years of hard work, my book is finally coming to fruition. I recently received the blue line from Brown Books Publishing Group, the final check before it goes to print next week. Seeing all my efforts on paper is probably the feeling. My book, Care to Win, The Four Leadership Habits of High-Performing Teams, is the culmination of my passion and purpose. All right, give us a little bit of a clip notes on what the book's about and then why you decided to write a book.
The book, Care to Win, The Four Leadership Habits of High-Performing Teams. So it just goes into the what it means to be a human. Every human being, we're survival machines, right? Nothing's changed. Again, swapped out saber-toothed tigers for bosses. It's, if we didn't know where the blueberries were, then we died, and those that died aren't here anymore. We need to know where it's safe. So it links to, well, what do we need to be safe? We need clarity. Without clarity, it leads to ambiguity. Ambiguity leads to fear. I can't perform at my best if I'm in fear mode. Autonomy. Who put your hands up if you love to be told how to do your job? Said no one ever. Micromanagement is dead. It's dead. It should never have existed. Command and control. People need a degree of flexibility and a say in things in order to spark their brains, which innovation is one of your values. So autonomy. We crave autonomy. We crave to be in control. We've got to stop stealing control. Relationships. We crave relationships because in the old day, if my cricket skills and my soccer skills weren't valued, it'd mean death because I'm not needed here. So we need to be valued for what we bring to the table. And equity is that sense of fairness. I mean, you've seen there's a wonderful research where you've got two monkeys. One's given a grape, one's given a rock. The monkey that gets the rock looks at the one, the grape, and goes, I want the grape. We are driven by fairness. And you see it in kids. My two kids are 5-year-old and seven-year-old. When one doesn't get what the other gets, the other one gets so angry. Nothing's different in the workplace. I've got to get that fairness. So clarity, autonomy, relationships, and equity, it goes into those four. What are they? Why do they matter? What stops us from doing it? And it gives everyone that sort of, I love Atomic Habits. My job with the book is to make you 1% better as a leader. And therefore, if you keep doing that as a habit, you'll be 37 times better at the end of a year. So it's giving you those little nuggets of habits that you can get better at.
James Clear, great book. Love Atomic Habits. Read it. I try to read it like once every couple of years just to kind of refresh. Building systems, not goals. I love it, man. Got it. I'm very excited about it. I'm assuming if I buy a copy, I'm going to get an autograph. That's happening.
You know what? I'll hand it to you. I'll come down to. I'm supposed to be in Florida today, but I'm not, so that's okay. But I'll come.
This is supposed to be our first in-person podcast. I'm not gonna lie. I'm a little bit bitter. A little bitter. Just kidding. We're gonna get back together. So here's my last question. What's one bit of advice you'd give 20-year-old Alex that you didn't know then, but that you know now?
Slow is smooth. Smooth is fast. You know, 20-year-old Alex was fast, rapid to make decisions, jumped to assumptions, trod on a few people that I wish I hadn't trod on. I wish I would be more methodical and have the time. Again, I've got half an hour in my calendar every day about what worked today, what didn't work today, and how do I make tomorrow a better day. I wish I'd done that. And invested in Bitcoin.
Ha! I love it. Alex, I got to tell you one thing. I'm gonna end the podcast like this. I'm going to retry to open up and share something with you that's going to bring us closer. Okay. 12-year-old Oz, when he first started learning about English soccer, okay, thought that the name of the team was Arsenal because they named it after Arsene Wagner. And so I didn't know that this was a club that had been around for hundreds of years, and it was just a coincidence. And I thought they named the actual club after him because he was the best manager in the team's history. Took me about 3 or 4 years to pick up on the fact that that was not actually the case. Who's your favorite gunner of all time?
Who's my favorite gunner? I mean, obviously on paper it's Thierry Henry, but actually I would have to go with Emmanuel Petit, the engine room in the middle of the park. That I always love the engine room. Right now it's Derek Rice for Liverpool. It's probably McAllister. There's an engine. It's the quiet engine that's the introvert or the quiet leader, the one that just gets shit done. No one talks about them, but without them, shit goes wrong. Emmanuel Petit was that person, as is McAllister. I love those people in general.
Men in Blazers doesn't got shit on us. This is the best soccer podcast around. My man, I appreciate you. Always a good time. Looking forward to seeing you in person. Hope to get that book handed to me, and I can't wait to read it. Thanks for the time, Alex. Yeah. Thank you for listening to Higher Learning with me, Oz Rashid. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode.